had a pretty successful fundraiser 2 days ago now.
Yeah, on Friday evening.
I don't know. I'm still kind of recovering from it. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. With me again, as usual, is Mike. Hey.
Hey.
And Becky. Hey.
How you doing?
So we did something we've never done before at a fundraiser. We sold the place out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a very pleasant surprise. It's actually the opposite problem. It's a better problem to have, is what do you do with extra people that want to get in, rather than how do you fill these seats. I'll take that problem any day, but I'd also take air conditioning.
Yes. Yeah, that was, it did get a little warm.
Well,
I thought,
you know, we couldn't plan for the 190 degree day in Seattle if September since 63 years. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've done one show in there before. I've been there for other things and it was never that warm. But then I realized it wasn't in a day like today or like it was yesterday. And I've never been in there when it was fully booked before. I mean, we actually doubled the number of people this time for the Delivered from Dogma event than we did for War on New Year's or Save Our Show. So I think that's really good. I think that speaks well for Ask an Atheist. I think it speaks well for, for the community.
Yeah, I think it's a definite move up. It says that our show is perhaps moving to another level, and there's something a little intimidating about that, but it's a challenge I like.
Yeah, and thank you to Ron Reed. Thank you to Emmett Montgomery. Thank you to Jeremy Whitman. Thank you to Brad Upton. You guys did great. It was a fantastic night. I think we all had fun.
Yeah, despite the heat, there was some great comedy going on that night.
There was. And speaking of comedy, we have a very interesting news story.
Do we?
Yes, this comes to us. I actually don't know where it comes to us from. But it's a Mexico religious sect who vows to fight over public schools. And this is in, it's in New Jerusalem, Mexico, but I imagine it's pronounced a little differently.
It's Nueva Jerusalén, which is the small little enclave in one of the in an area of Michoacán, which is a western state of Mexico.
Okay. The New Jerusalem sect was founded in 1973 by a parish priest, Nabor Cardenas, who disagreed with the modernization of the Catholic Church and the abandoning of the Latin Mass. So another Vatican II guy. An illiterate 63-year-old local farm woman, Gabina Sanchez, heard the voice of the Virgin Mary, or claims to have heard the voice of the Virgin Mary. Together, they directed the evolution of Nueva Jerusalem, creating an idiosyncratic vision of how life would have been lived in biblical times, and imposing it on thousands of followers. Religious leaders say the community's rules are aimed at banishing all of the vices and bad habits that condemn the rest of the world to perdition. Apparently, the government went in there to build the usual, you know, public education infrastructure, and the government mandated uniforms, books, and technology now used in many Mexican classrooms apparently would violate the Virgin Mary's orders on their sacred ground, which in this case, their sacred ground is the entirety of the town, yeah?
Yes, the entirety of this little enclave, this little town in Michoacán, is apparently the New Jerusalem where the Virgin Mary appeared and says, establish it all here, and the end times will save you.
So, organized squadrons of church followers used sledgehammers and pickaxes to tear down at least two school buildings in July, and then they burned the furniture and the textbooks inside. And in August, authorities vowed that public secular education, one of the few common bonds that hold Mexican society together, would not be sacrificed, pledging that children would be back in class in New Jerusalem. So conservative church followers formed a line inside the gates of their town to face down dozens of federal and state police who showed up with patrol trucks and armored vehicles. The dispute remains unresolved even as the school year has already begun.
So we're talking about the federales versus basically angry Amish religious zealots?
Right, basically.
Yeah, it's a very weird kind of sect, and this just breaks my heart. I mean, I'm a school teacher. I've just gone back to school. You know, I'm a Spanish teacher, and we're actually looking for Spanish dictionaries. They're a hot commodity in my classroom right now.
Right.
And to have a community burn the books, the furniture, anything that's there, and tear down the actual school because it is an affront to what they think should be, should be that what everyone should do. The craziest thing about this is that instead of going to school and being educated, even in, you know, with any kind of modern things, including radio and internet, even if you exclude that, the traditionalist folks don't even want their kids attending their own kind of private school. What they want kids doing is forming an unbreakable prayer chain 24 hours long without interruption. I mean, forgive me, you know, Mike, you're a fan of the series Lost.
Yes.
If I may out you as a fan of series Lost. You know, does it not remind you of Desmond needing to push the button on timed intervals? I mean,
yeah, it's a bit like that. So what is it that they actually believe will happen if somebody doesn't, I guess you could say, forward the prayer, if somebody doesn't tag in and continue?
Honestly, I could ask that about Lost, too, because... Wow, I totally didn't understand that. I am not a fan of Lost, but go on.
Well, you know what? The thing about breaking the prayer chain, I don't know if there's something, you know, bad that will happen, but they say that, you know, the continuance of the prayer chain will help ensure their safety during the end times. You know, also the other great thing.
Didn't they have a couple of end times predictions in
yes.
the 80s and 90s?
Yes, yeah. We are here a fan of end of the world sort of predictions yeah. that end up failed. The most recent one for them was 1999.
Really?
Yes. Also, their original founders, their illiterate oracle and their renegade Catholic bishop, have since passed away.
Right.
And so now you've got this weird thing of these traditionalists that really say, no, kids shouldn't be in school. They should wear this particular, you know, religious uniform and just pray all day.
This might be morbid of me, but the transition from when a cult leader or a destructive group leader, however you want to classify it, you know, dies, and how that organization usually passes through it, because most of the time, without that charismatic guy at the top, the organization just doesn't survive.
Yeah, there's some cults, like, say, for instance, the Unification Church of Sung Young Moon.
Right.
I think it's going to go on because there is a strong second in command. You know, Bo Hee Pak, the same thing with Scientology after L. Ron Hubbard died, is that you have David Miscavige taking over. Then you have something like, say, the Lyndon LaRouche cult, where there is no number two. It's all about this one guy, and there's no coherent ideology. I think the coherent ideology is what's keeping this alive.
Yeah, Lyndon LaRouche is weird, and for those of you who go, wait, Lyndon LaRouche, isn't he a politician? Yes, he is, but he's a political cult. You do look into it, and actually, we hope to do a show on that sometime, but it's not... Lyndon LaRouche is not selling, you know, some spirituality or some new type of politics. Most of the time, Lyndon LaRouche is really just trying to sell Lyndon LaRouche.
But it's the same product, no matter what the cult is, which is that only this man can save the world.
Yeah.
Whether it's through politics
well,
or...
Well, only X can save the world. Sometimes it's, you know, it changes from time to time, but you're right. It's just the details.
It all comes down to that this method is the only way.
Yeah.
And in this cult in Mexico, we're talking about the prayer chain and this very specific, weird, rogue, I guess you could say, bastardized version of Catholicism.
Right.
And one of the things I just found fascinating about this was the very specific ban on sports.
Oh, yeah. This is great.
That they ban football in the international sense, we're talking soccer, it's
yeah.
banned because the ball is round and they don't want you kicking a round ball because it represents the round earth, which I'm glad they at least think that's round.
Yeah.
And yet, American football is not banned because it doesn't have, the ball is not round.
I'm sure there's some oblong-shaped planet out there that's perfectly fine to kick and desecrate.
Oh, jeez.
I'm not sure. No, you're right. There's you know, all the hallmarks of this very sort of, you know, this destructive group. It controls people's actions, what they're allowed to wear. You know, you cannot enter this, you know, this sort of gated enclave if you are wearing short skirts or if you are a woman who's wearing pants, if you have sleeveless blouses, if you have makeup or nail polish, and if you haven't covered your heads. I mean, every girl wears a head covering.
Yeah. I mean, isn't this, weren't you telling me before that this organization keys what children and women wear by colors of the rainbow?
Yes. Yes. Pre-adolescent girls all wear yellow, and
yeah.
oddly enough, they're all referred to as the Juanitas.
Okay.
They all have sort of an order that they adopt this name. It's very strange.
It's like something out of Jack and Jill.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, and sort of, you know, the unmarried woman, adult women wear blue, and then, you know, married and paired, you know, people all wear different colors, and
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, sort of their religious orders, and they're standing within the community. But it's all very tightly controlled.
Are these guys related to Mel Gibson's dad, you think, Mike? Or?
Well, they're reacting to the exact same thing as Mel Gibson's dad,
okay.
which is that this change in the church from the Latin Mass to a Mass that is actually in the language of the people listening to it.
Mm.
You know, it I don't know. Maybe call me crazy, but I think it's a good idea to actually understand the things that the guy at the pulpit is saying.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mel Gibson's dad. Pretty good band name, I think. So we have a really fun interview today. Nicky Stern's first book, Because I Say So, The Dangerous Appeal of Moral Authority, explored a cultural standard of unequivocal moral certainty through the lens of her experience as a 9/11 widow. Her newest book, Hope in Small Doses, was released this spring and takes a natural next step in exploring how hope might be sustained, even in the wake of tragedy and uncertainty. Following her husband's death on 9/11, Nicky challenged herself to find meaning, even especially as a skeptic. Combining research and reflection, she's arrived at a version of hope that thrives not on certainty, but on possibility. How are you doing today, Nicky?
Hi.
Hi.
So, Nicky, it's so nice to have you on the show today. You know, we're right now, you know, we're more than a decade outside of the 9/11 attacks, and losing your husband must have been devastating.
Yeah, it was.
Clearly. And you know, it seems that instead of immediately cleaving to hope, you became initially more steadfast and outspoken in your skepticism. Can you sort of tell us about that journey a little bit?
Well, I was reacting in part to reactions around me. I kind of went into 9/11 as a skeptic and an agnostic. I just didn't really think much about or expect much from in the way of deliverance from a higher power. And of course, this terrible thing happened, and like everybody else, I struggled with the why and all of that. But that part of it was easier for me to deal with than, for example, my in-laws or a lot of the people that I worked with as executive director of a families group. Most of them were torn between deciding that God had a plan and believing that God had forsaken them. I guess I was fortunate, and I'm putting little quotation marks around that. No, that was not something that I went through. I was a little bit appalled, which is why I guess I wrote the first book on people's need, people's translation for a need to understand what had happened and make sense of what happened into something concrete, as in, well, we are morally justified or morally obligated to go after the perpetrators. You know, my feeling was most of the perpetrators had died on the plane, but there were a whole series, as we know, of decisions, policy decisions that were kind of predicated on American moral authority, and I had a real problem with that. But it wasn't even so much that my skepticism increased, is that knowing what I already believed and seeing it come true, if you will, in kind of its worst manifestation, I didn't understand how I could possibly wake up in the morning, you know, absent absolute guarantee that God would make sense of everything in the end, how I could wake up in the morning and feel good about anything or want to continue.
Wow. You know, you had mentioned that you were the executive director of the Families of 9/11 group. You know, so many existing support structures that we have for dealing with grief are religiously grounded or try and speak to someone's belief about an afterlife, about reunification after death. So are we, as skeptics or doubters, are we kind of stuck being alone in grief, or is there some kind of way that we can communally grieve free from religious overtones?
To be very, very fair and to give this some perspective, the group that formed out of 9/11, not so much the support groups with therapists and all, because they were all, some of them formed in churches and some of them did not, but the groups like the one I headed were really created to address practical concerns, from remains and death certificate to any kind of lawsuits that families might want to institute, to where they could find help across the country, especially if they were outside of New York, to any kind of input they wanted into legislation or whatever. I've had more personal experience and difficulty in, for example, directing friends and loved ones to Alcoholics Anonymous when it didn't suit either them or me as a friend or family member to you know, trust that God would make everything okay in relation to their particular addiction. But I do think that in terms of grieving, I think that this the people that I ran into who were affected by 9/11, the most active people, tended to be Oh dear, the family members who were from very religious families, they came from backgrounds and environments in which the cohesive family unit was a religiously grounded one, and I certainly ran into a lot of circumstances where I was told by other family members that I couldn't understand the concern about the souls that were trapped at ground zero or this or that, and all of that was very true. And so in dealing with them that way, I did at times experience a personal sense of isolation, because I didn't have answers that I could pull up by, you know, going to church. Excuse me. I have a dog. He cannot be quiet when I'm doing a phone interview. It's genetically impossible.
It's the way with us too. We have cats who love to come up and start eating the phone cords whenever we're on the phone. So
yep.
So you have a question, right?
Yes. Your book is called.
Stop laughing long enough.
your book is called Hope in Small Doses. The notion of hope is often so intangible. I mean, skeptics place such a high priority on evidence. How does a skeptic arrive at hope or use hope while retaining a commitment to the natural material world?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm kind of fond of my little book because I deliberately posited it as Hope in Small Doses so that I could lay it out as a pragmatic approach. So that first we look at what hope is and how it is primarily in the class of people that tie it to certainty, either the certainty that's granted to you by a divine being, or the certainty that in a couple of cases, like the proponents of the secret, is granted to you because you just can go out and get anything you want if you just put out the exactly right thing into the universe. Neither of which I believe, or ever believed. And so, and I knew that there were a number of people, because I interviewed people just on the street before I started this project. I'm in Princeton, New Jersey, so there may be an abundance of skeptics. But what I found is that people didn't so much believe, with a couple of exceptions. They weren't looking for hope they didn't believe in hope as something that came from God above. They didn't believe in hope at all. And I said, well, that's not right. I'm not willing to let that go because I think that that's the thing that will get us up in the morning and give us purpose. So I wanted to look at hope that gives purpose. And a hope that gives purpose has to be, I think, redefined so that guarantees are out of the equation.
So you went out and, right. You know, when you were going out and seeking people's responses to that, mm-hmm. was that sort of the biggest thread, or is that different or similar to how you envisioned hope and talk about it in your book?
I wasn't surprised that people, that the people I interviewed who may have been like-minded people, that tends to happen. I wasn't surprised that they didn't see how it was possible for a less than absolutely certain person to be hopeful. But what I was surprised at is how pervasive this notion of hope, how confusing our understanding or vision of hope is, and at the same time how pervasive the notion is that hope is tied to something, is tied to some kind of superstitious thing out in the universe that's just going to make, if you just hope for it, everything will be all right. My research and my perspective, granted, indicate that for a lot of people, hope is anything but certainty. It is and can be much more of a plan of action.
You know, it really struck me as well that, you know, for so many people, the concept of hope is so integrally linked to faith or belief. And, mm-hmm. you know, is there sort of a common vocabulary that we can have where we can talk about hope, sort of recognize these different connotations that we have in our own sense and in our communities?
Well, I think so. I think I'm very fascinated by words and meanings and cultural connotations around concepts and ideas. And
wow.
So the idea that
we don't know anybody like that.
That was a mouthful. I don't even know what I just said. Please don't quote me on that. But
oh no, it's great. I'm a linguist and a language teacher, and I support definitions and words all the way.
But I find it interesting that that even Merriman and Webster and Oxford, they all tied hope to expectations, and they tied expectations to outcome, and nobody, I felt as if we almost had to seize control of some of the vocabulary, and faith is one of those words. And I say at the end of the book, or near the end of the book, I say, I have faith too. I have faith in man's ability to, and dot, 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 whatever it is I say. So I think that the first order of business might be to redefine, or rather expand, the notion of faith. Faith doesn't mean faith that everything will turn out all right, or faith that some higher power has a plan and so don't worry about it. Not at all.
Nikki, that's a really interesting, I'd love to talk to you about that. We need to go into break. Can you stick with us while we do some?
Yeah, I can.
All right. We're talking with Nikki Stern, who has a book called Hope in Small Doses with the Humanist Press. We are Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We're going to go into a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistofwashington.org.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules, a variation on our usual fantasy campaign system. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, as well as a listing of other products and to get involved in the community forums.
Billy! I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it will explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
This November in Washington State, we have an opportunity to strike a blow against religious privilege and become the first state to legalize marriage equality by a majority of voters.
Some people might be confused about why we're asking you to vote to approve Referendum 74. I mean, didn't the people opposed to equal rights get this on the ballot? Well, yeah, they did.
When the Washington State Legislature passed marriage equality earlier this year and Governor Gregoire signed it, the religious right challenged that law.
Now we are the legislature.
When you vote to approve Referendum 74, you are voting to approve the exact same bill the legislature passed.
We believe that real religious liberty means a secular government that respects diversity, where no one's religious ideology is imposed on anyone through the force of law.
Vote to approve extending equality and respect to all Washington families. Vote to approve Referendum 74 this November 6th.
To help make it happen, donate to Washington United for Marriage through the Ask an Atheist team page.
Go to askanatheist.tv/r74.
We're the producers of Ask an Atheist,
and we paid for this ad.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And first, let's talk about everybody who's helping bring Season 10 to the air. This week, we have Peggy's Challenge, these Peggy's Challenge donators.
Neth from Lake Forest Park, Washington.
We've got Brandon from Lafayette, Colorado.
Jack from Coopville, Washington.
Eric from Everett, Washington.
And PS Audio and Video from San Diego. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to help bring Season 10 to the air, you can go to askanatheist.tv and click on the red button. We also have next week, we're going to be doing a pre-recorded episode. And while that's happening, we're going to be in Kennewick with Sean Faircloth, who is speaking who's speaking with the Tri-City Freethinkers?
Yes, Tri-City Freethinkers at the Kennewick Public Library at 2 p.m. on next Sunday, the 16th.
And you can search meetup.com for that, or go to the richarddawkins.net events calendar. And finally, just like last year, that's a same verse, same as the first, but man, it's an important one.
Yes, the Evening Magazine, which is a local news magazine that's on the NBC affiliate, is doing their Best of Western Washington Awards. These are a big deal. A lot of people are involved, thousands of voters, and everyone who wins gets a 2 to 3 minute slot on NBC affiliate here in Seattle, and that is invaluable public visibility.
That would be really good for us. So,
Ask an Atheist is up for Best Local Podcast.
Yes, we are. So go ahead and askanatheist.tv, and information on how to vote is available on the website.
Yes, right now there's a weird tech issue going on with the King 5 website, so please be patient. Go back, check back in a couple days. But anyways, please go there, help us out. Every vote counts.
All right, so we're talking with Nikki Stern, the author of Because I Say So, The Dangerous Appeal of Moral Authority, and Hope in Small Doses. And before we went into the break, you were talking about how you have faith in things too. And that's kind of a weird thing with me. If I've had that discussion, and I say that the kind of faith that we talk about, the faith that is faith that the sun will rise, the faith in humanity, the faith in our friends, is ultimately a different thing than faith in the supernatural, because in many ways we have proof. But you say that no, they're kind of the same thing.
Well, we do have proof, or at least we have a mountain of evidence that the sun will rise. And we do, and so that's one thing. Faith in our friends is partially based on evidence, but it's also partially based on something that is a little hard to define. My faith, which I sometimes find weird, in the ultimate, ability of man, I won't say the ultimate goodness of mankind, but the ultimate ability of man, mankind or humankind to be good is something I feel strongly about. So in humankind's potential. So yeah, those are the kinds of things I have faith in. I also have faith in our ability to reason. I have faith in the evolution of our brains. Those are the kinds of, and I have faith in our eventual ability to understand and develop our moral center.
And
I don't think we need anybody outside of us to do that.
I think the way that you're using faith, I would not disagree with you. I think we're kind of on the same page there. But in evolution and the evolution of morality, the faith in my friends and stuff like that. We are social creatures. We evolved as tribal beings, and that sort of social net that we have built is the process by which the human capacity for basically anything evolved.
And that's the wonderful thing about humanism. I mean, the absolutely wonderful thing that I don't know that people adequately understand. Humanists are not, it's not that they're anti, stop with the anti, they're pro-people.
Right.
And I'm pro-people.
Yeah.
Maybe not individuals at times.
I'm a humanist, and I do, I am an anti-theist. I think religion is painful, but that is part of the humanist stance. But what our focus on, like what we say is atheism is not a statement of belief for us. Atheism is just the idea and the concept and that there is no God. That's what atheism is. When I talk about...
I was going to say, apolitical means considering politics to be relevant.
Right.
And I always considered the real definition of atheism, for me anyway, to be more a question of the idea that theism is, it's just, whether there's a deity is just irrelevant. And I do say that, and I, with all respect to everybody who might be listening who is a theist, it's not that I'm anti people who are theists. I just think that the question is irrelevant to how we obtain purpose, how we develop our moral code, and how we live our lives. So for me, an atheist is a person that says, oh, that's just not, I mean, fine, talk about it over drinks if you want, but it just has nothing to do with how we live our lives.
Fair enough.
At least in my life.
The second part of that for me is for a statement of what I do believe in. That's where humanism comes in.
Right.
You know, you're published under the Humanist Press. Is your intended audience for your book, Hope in Small Doses, is your intended audience humanists or skeptics? Or is it a sort of a wider intended audience?
Well, of course it's wider for two reasons. One is I really want to sell more books. And the other is that what I think a lot of people doubt, and I don't want the people who doubt or who don't have all the answers, or who wake up some mornings without the answers, to feel shoved in a box. One of the blurbs that I have, the one that's on the front cover, is from Barry Lynn, who's the head of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Barry Lynn is also an ordained reverend. He's a very liberal Christian. And he is someone that does not choose to and cannot define what his spiritual, you know, deity is, but he believes there is one. But he could relate to hope in small doses because he likes the idea of its focus on not waiting for something above to make you guarantees, but to do what you can with what you know and can discover about and for yourself.
So you've talked a bit about individuals and the country's shared grief and the shared anger even more than a decade after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and our collective need to move towards unity and peace. Did your ideas of measured hope stem from that call or something more personal?
My ideas about hope stemmed, honestly, from my need to find as I, you know, entered widowhood, I suppose, or was going to possibly spend the rest of my life as a single person when I never wanted to, and also to navigate in a world that becomes confusing, to kind of take the long view, and also to grow old, well, if not gracefully, I doubt I'll do that, but to at least have some things about which I'm excited. And so my exploration of hope is built on what it is that I already like that I can kind of put in the front of my brain and kind of elevate and make part of my purpose. And it involves a great deal of tolerance, not only for the views of others, but for my capabilities. You know, I think in order to practice hope in small doses, you have to cut yourself some slack. I think you have to lower your expectations and cut yourself some slack, but you have to also know that it is possible to be, in some measure, fairly optimistic and joyous every day.
And oh, I'm sorry.
That's what I think.
Oh, well, you said you mentioned the beliefs of others, and mm-hmm. there are some in the religious communities that they feel that their way to get past this anger and grief is in erecting a cross at, like, the 9/11 museum. This, to be fair, has incited some strong feelings from the non-religious folks who feel also deeply affected by the event and the aftermath. What's your feeling on how we reconcile that?
Honestly, I majored in history, and my father was a historian. And I'm also a big believer in picking one's battles. And the cross represents something that a group of people believed represented something. And I don't think you have to believe that it represents something in order to assess its historical value and merit as part of the story of 9/11. I was there. I was there as a non-theist and as a skeptic and as a very personally involved grieving person. And I know that many people took comfort in that artifact. So not including that artifact because non-theists might be offended, it doesn't make sense to me. I know it doesn't seem fair that maybe the non-theists have to take the higher road in this regard, but I think they do. I think it needs to be included.
I'm willing to go that far. I see that argument, but you said, you know, you have an understanding of history. You have training in history. History is also something of mine, so I definitely hear that argument. But we also historically we've also seen people use religious symbolism in the public space and in public spaces as sort of a if I may borrow a phrase, a wedge argument to say that America is a Christian nation and stuff like that.
Oh, and that's an honest concern
for a lot of people.
You got to be vigilant because I think that, you know, now we're into semantics again. Is America a Christian majority nation? Yes.
Yeah.
Does that mean that the founding fathers, or that I believe the founding fathers intended for this country to operate according to, someone's definition of what Christian values mean? I don't think so. I think we ought to be beyond that at this point, and have, arrived at an understanding of a shared sense of moral, you know, shared value system that doesn't derive from one or the other religious, tradition. And I would like to think we are at that point, and because we're not, yeah, I think that the symbolism can be used as a bludgeon, and I think we have to guard against that. But I think that the 9/11 museum, which is what they're talking about, including this cross, is a different situation.
So what should be the response when religious people, and again, we all agree this does happen, try to co-opt tragedies that happen to believers and non-believers alike?
I think people need to be reminded of their commonality, and the commonality is in the immediacy of a tragedy or a loss, and that the response to the loss is going to be as multifold as varied as presumably were the victims. If a church is bombed, or you know, all the members are lost of a congregation, it would make sense that there might be a particular response. But I think we should speak out loudly and forcefully against people who make comments about tragedies being a manifestation of God's will. I mean, number one, frankly, they always get it wrong. Pat Roberts just keeps sticking his foot in his mouth. Every time something happens, he says, well, is God speaking out against homosexuality, or God speaking out, and you just want to punch the guy. I mean, he's so wrong. And, you know, it's important to just say no and cut it off. While trying at the same time to respect people who need something, and that's their business, what they need. It's just that they can't make these kind of horrific, overarching statements that are thinly disguising their biases. You know, we just can't allow that.
Well, Nikki, if any of the things that you're saying today are sort of a preview or a little taste of what's in both of your books or either of your books, it sounds like especially Hope in Small Doses would be a great sort of book group read for folks working through some really tough times. And, you know, if non-believers and believers were to discuss the book together, what kinds of things do you think would be salient in those kinds of discussions?
I think the idea that paying attention to the details of one's lives and then learning to prioritize those details so that that what is bad doesn't get dismissed or ignored, but what is good gets a little more prominence. I think everybody could agree on that. I think everybody might be able to agree on the importance of reaching out to one's fellow person. And I think that the idea that discovery can be a very joyful thing, and that the process of discovery makes life extremely worthwhile at any age, including mm-hmm. right near the end. You know, if you keep learning, then your brain keeps working. If your brain keeps working, you have a purpose. And when it stops working, well, that's another story. But as long as it's working and you can keep exercising it, it's a very wonderful thing.
So you wrote about really disliking aspirations to stupidity in an article you wrote called Is Stupid the New Black?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I did.
how do we maintain hope in a world where we have this sort of reality television and sort of fashionable ignorance?
Oh my gosh. You know, and we do. We do. My physical therapist said to me the other day when I gave him a copy of my book, he said, wow, you know, I haven't read a book since 1996. And I said to him really loud so that other people could hear, I said, are you proud of that? God, ew. You know, I made him feel bad, but I try to celebrate people, and I know it's probably a smaller group than it should be, but I try to celebrate people who are, in whatever fashion they're doing it are kind of giving a thumbs up to learning and exploration. And I closed my ears and eyes to the junk. There's a lot of junk, but there was a lot of junk at penny novels and stupid racy postcards, you know, at the end of the 19th century in Victorian England. So the majority of people like junk, but for example, there's a Facebook page, and I'm not sure what you're allowed to say on a podcast. You're allowed to
Well, we're actually on the air. We're on a radio station.
Okay, so I can't use the F word.
Yeah, no, please don't.
I won't, but it's I effing love science.
Yes.
And I effing love that page. Because although, you know, okay, fine, it's a little bit, did they have to use the F word? Fine. But these people, and they have a million followers, and they send around these wonderful, wonderful things about science that I don't always know or you know, reminders and stuff. And I mean, it makes me fall in love with, I fall in love with Facebook, you know, all over again when I get things like that. And the humanist page makes me fall in love with Facebook. And the commercials you guys just ran where the Queen of England, the know-it-all Queen of England is trying to tell people, you know, what to think. And it's an advertisement for a course in critical thinking. I mean, that just makes me so happy.
Yeah.
I allow those things to make me happy, and I feel happier because of them.
Yeah. There was a quote by John Waters that I've always really liked, and I think maybe this is a way to enforce that or encourage it. He said that if you go to somebody's house and they don't have any books, not to sleep with them.
That has always been a rule of mine.
So how can our listeners find your book or some of your essays online?
I made it easy. I have a website called hopeinsmalldoses.com.
All right.
That's if you don't remember my name, NikkiStern.com, because I also have a website that leads into hopeinsmalldoses.com from NikkiStern.com. So just remember one or the other.
All right.
You know, either one.
Nikki, thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
Nikki Stern's first book, Because I Say So, The Dangerous Appeal of Moral Authority, is on sale. And also, she has a new book out this spring called Hope in Small Doses. Both books are available at the Humanist Press. And if you'd like direct links to purchasing those books, you can go to our website, askanatheist.tv, and see it. So we are going to go into a break. And when we come back, we're going to have a moment of science.
Tacoma Telematics wants to help you connect with your clients. We can give you a top-notch web presence. Tacoma Telematics can take your website to the next level and make it an essential part of your business marketing, but that's not all. Want VoIP? We've got it, bringing large corporation phone systems capability at mom-and-pop prices. We build intuitive interfaces to help you manage your resources quickly and efficiently. Take advantage of our holistic approach to make your business communications succeed effortlessly. At Tacoma Telematics, we're committed to personal and professional integrity, open communication, and long-term relationships. See us at TacomaTelematics.com.
Looking to sell or buy a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, and surrounding areas? Plant your roots and invest in this entrepreneur-friendly area with world-class education and healthcare. Demand a professional and call Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 and let him work with you to achieve your goals, save your time, and protect your investment. Contact Dawn Summers of Professional Realty Group at dndrealty.ca. It's time you hired a professional.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
Today's atheist movement isn't just about what we don't believe in, it's about what we do believe in. On September 15th, our sponsor, Seattle Atheists, is holding the annual board member elections and big idea meeting. And they want to hear from you. What do you want our local godless organization to take on? Our input will shape their actions. Interested in getting involved? Seattle Atheists is seeking engaged, civic-minded non-theists who want to affect real change in our communities. Whether you identify as a secular humanist focused on social justice, or as a freethinker who's determined to keep religion out of government, our involvement is needed now. What will you do to shape the future? Seattle Atheists Elections and the Big Idea Meeting are on Saturday, September 15th at 2 p.m. at the Shoreline Public Library.
library. Attendance is open to everyone, with membership required to vote and run for office. For a full list of open positions and to read candidate statements, visit seattleatheists.org. Seattle Atheists Big Idea Meeting. seattleatheists.org.
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
This is Ask an Atheist on Clay 1180 AM in Tacoma, and here we've got Dan Lombardo with A Moment of Science.
Hi, I'm Dan Lombardo, and this is A Moment of Science. This week, I want to talk to you about the evolution of morality. You probably noticed that most of the people you meet have a kind of social code of ethics or morals, and that most of these codes are pretty similar, but why do we share some of these basic ideals, and where do they come from? Evolution. I'll go ahead and assume that most of you know what evolution is and have a basic idea of how it works, but for those that don't, here's a very quick rundown. All living things inherit their DNA from their biological predecessors. For us humans, that means mom and dad. Your DNA affects the characteristics of your physical body, including your brain and nervous system, which in turn affect your behavior patterns and thought process. Traits in the DNA that help an organism survive to reproduce will become more common as they're passed on to the next generation of offspring, while traits that hinder survival or reproduction become less common. Simple, right? Well, there's more to it, of course, but that's the basics of evolution in a nutshell. Now, let's imagine two populations of our very far-removed ancestors. Both of them are trying to survive in a dangerous world full of bears, big cats, diseases, droughts, famines, rival groups, and other dangers. The first population has some individuals that we'll call cooperators. That is, they're willing to share tasks, such as hunting, gathering, child-rearing, and guarding the group. These cooperators are genetically predisposed to these social behaviors. The second population has few, if any, cooperators, and each individual in the group is only concerned with themselves and their own offspring. Now, imagine that both groups face a sudden threat, such as a new predator moving into the area, shall we say, a saber-toothed cat. The first group bands together against the new threat, warning the others in their group and perhaps even forming a united defense against Old Smiley, because they're united in their actions. This first group survives and passes on their genes to the next generation, who will form a similar, maybe even better, defense against future threats, and the cooperative genes they carry propagate even further. When the second group is faced by the saber-toothed cat, things don't go so well. Their every-man-for-himself attitude means that they scatter in fear when they see it. There's no warning to the other members, and no united defense against this slashing horror beast. Needless to say, many of the non-cooperators will not survive to pass on their uncooperative genes. What we're outlining here is the biological value of socially cohesive behaviors. Behaviors that maintain and encourage closeness in the group, such as sharing tasks and resources, conflict resolution, and organized defense. So the first group, full of cooperators, eventually displaces the second, and before long the capacity to share with others and care for them is a very common trait indeed, leading to the social norm of basic altruism. This basic altruism can be more or less equated to the do unto others line that you'll find in one form or another in nearly every human religion and philosophy. We're kind to each other because at some point it started helping us survive, and it continues to do so. Now, it always gets weird, and here's where it does. Socially cohesive altruistic behavior is not limited to human beings. It's present in some of our close relatives as well, like bonobos and chimpanzees, and some of our far-off cousins, like elephants and wolves, but it doesn't stop there. Many species of whales, dolphins, catfish, ants, bees, termites, and even colonial shrimps have a social code, a real set of ethics by which they run their lives in order to maintain the cohesiveness of the group. Now, we've talked about how and why we might evolve morality, but where is it going? Well, let's take a little look at our history. Not so long ago, cannibalism was an acceptable practice, but it fell out of favor. Later, slavery was an acceptable practice, but it also fell out of favor. More recently, inequality between men and women was considered acceptable, but it appears to be on its way out, as well as prejudices against others based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion's preferences. Our morality is still undeniably evolving to this very day and will likely continue to do so for many generations more. So how should we behave? Well, I'd say let's go with the old golden rule, with a slight modification via the famously awesome American chemist and peace activist Linus Pauling, who said, "Do unto others 20% better than you would expect them to do unto you, to correct for subjective error." But explaining subjective error is another talk for another day. I'm Dan Lombardo, and I hope you enjoyed this moment of science.
Thank you very much, Dan. That was pretty fun. So we have an email that Mike has been itching to do for some time. And are you ready?
Am I supposed to like cheer or like?
Yeah, that would help. Okay.
Was that enough?
I think it helps the show, but not necessarily my ears. And this comes to us from Jay from England, and it's a very simple email. Why do atheists only talk about Leviticus in the Bible, Mike?
Well, we frequently talk about Leviticus because it's kind of an awful book full of terrible things, one of the most prominent of which is killing gay people with throwing rocks at them.
Right.
But it's not the only book of the Bible we talk about. So we used to have a segment on this show, and we do occasionally, called Scripture Says What? Where we talked about this, and we didn't limit ourselves to Leviticus. So let me give you some examples here from other books. In Genesis, Lot, who's the good guy in this story, protects angels from a rape gang by saying, no, take my daughters instead. In the book of 2 Kings, we have the prophet Elisha, who, after being made fun of by a gang of children, sicks a group of bears on them.
Yeah.
You have Ephesians, this is the New Testament, telling slaves to submit to their masters, particularly if their master is a Christian. So I guess it's okay for Christians to own slaves. Also, in Matthew, we talk about people who reject Jesus will be thrown into the furnace of hell, where there's going to be the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Oh, in Deuteronomy, this is a twofer. Not only do they tell a woman that she has to marry her rapist, but if a woman is found to not be a virgin on her wedding night, she's to be taken to her father's doorstep and stoned to death.
Wow.
Exodus tells us to kill witches, and in the book of Revelation, Jews are referred to as the synagogue of Satan. So, no, it's not just Leviticus.
No, why do we like to go to Leviticus? I think it's because comedy. It's not because we think Leviticus is the only book in the Bible. I think it's because it's one of the more amusing books in the Bible. What do you think about that?
Well, you know what? Leviticus is such an easy thing to say, hey, you know what? If you are a biblical literalist and if you think that the Bible is the Word of God, it's unerring, and we should follow every single piece of it, then Leviticus is a very easy book with lots of things to point to say, you know what? You don't actually follow this, and you don't follow it because you're a good person.
Yeah, Bob Seidensticker, who we've had on the show, and he's got a book out, and who's sort of a, you know, anti-apologetic samurai, he doesn't refer to Leviticus a lot. He doesn't fall towards it because his point is not comedy or pointing out necessarily absurd things in the Bible. He's anti-apologetics. He's trying to tell you why these arguments don't make sense, and he's going to use the whole book to do it.
Yeah, and I think this really gets down to this moral question. Can we be moral without this hand-me-down, all-encompassing rule book saying that you have to have this authority figure or a security camera to be a good person?
Yeah.
In fact, I say it's the opposite. I'd say that morality is what you do when you're not being watched, when you know that there's nobody who can punish you for what you do.
Right.
And I'd say morality, in fact, is not being told what to do like a farm animal. Like if my cat jumps up on a shelf and I shoot him with a water gun and say, no, bad, and I'm just not jumping up there to avoid punishment. Morality is understanding why something is bad and not wanting to do it.
Right, right.
I love that that's how our morality has evolved. Initially, it was the saber-toothed Mr. Smiley Cat that was, you know, watching out for us.
Yeah, interesting how all of this, the interview and the moment of science and these emails all sort of knit together. But yeah, why do people talk about Leviticus? Because Leviticus is hilarious. Come on. There's some primo material in there. You could crack jokes about stuff in Leviticus all day.
Leviticus is like the book of the Bible that atheists made up to make fun of the Bible.
I know. Two words, minstrel hut. I mean, seriously, it's...
I tend to like Exodus with four-legged insects.
Was it the bat thing that
bat
I read?
Bat birds.
Yeah, bat birds and, oh, man.
Rabbits that chew cud.
The best line in the entire Bible, look this up, open to your page, to Deuteronomy 25:11-12. This is, again, if two men are fighting.
Oh, right.
And the woman of one of the men intercedes in the fight and grabs one of the men by the junk, that you have to cut the woman's hand off.
Yeah, and that's not Leviticus. But I honestly, with all the weird animals, it seems like Leviticus should be a Dr. Seuss book.
Yes, I think I will do a Dr. Seuss illustration of Leviticus.
Yeah, I'm not saying I want to see that. It just seems like that's what it would be.
Oh, I want to see it.
Okay.
I'm going to make it happen.
I think it might make me a little depressed.
I'll do an Indiegogo event for it.
So we have one more email, which we will do quickly, and this comes to us from Heather from Kissimmee, Florida. Why are there so many religions created? Being that I was a Christian, I'm obviously more curious as to why the whole God, Jesus, Holy Trinity, Satan idea was started. Who did they think would benefit upon its inception? Thank you again.
Well, why are there so many religions? Because there's so many people.
Yeah.
There's so many people spread out over the world in isolated populations. Of course, we later met up with each other, sometimes to kill each other over those differences. But really, everyone approached these sort of questions of meaning and understanding and why the sun comes up and why there are storms in different ways.
Yeah. You know, not only did we evolve morality because it was beneficial to us as organisms, but we also developed this really kind of funny way of seeing patterns in things and looking for explanations to things and assigning value and meaning to things that maybe were completely random. And that was an evolutionarily beneficial trait that we picked up on.
Religion was a plan, was an idea that we're going to describe the world. We're going to make the world sensical. And they used whatever tools they had available and whatever context they had available. You have populations in different places with different things and different world, you know, different biomes around them and different tools. And yeah, of course the story is going to change.
Yeah, I guess I like the way that Christopher Hitchens put it, where religion was the first draft attempt to try to make sense of the world,
yeah.
Science being the much more evolved one that actually involves all this evidence that and data that we've gathered just from living in the world.
Yeah.
Like astrology becomes astronomy, religion eventually becomes myth, and our understanding of the world gets transferred to something like science.
Yeah, and that's what I like about using the word myth, is it doesn't completely discount the usefulness of these interesting stories that we've written up, but when we say it's myth, it's because it's not actually descriptive of the world anymore.
Yeah, people aren't killing each other over Zeus and Thor anymore, thankfully, at least not that I've heard of, and I actually long for a day that we actually talk about Jesus in the same way. Maybe he becomes a mythological figure that joins the Avengers in much the same way that Thor and Hercules have.
Do you think our lifetime times 10, or our lifetime times 100?
There's no way to tell. I mean, clearly there's some legs for this whole Christianity thing, so it's still very powerful. Who knows when these things fall apart?
Yeah, I'm going to just throw out my lifetime times 100 out there. I'd like to hear about it. I'd like to see what people think about it. This is Ask an Atheist. My name is Sam Mulvey. With me was Mike Gillis and Rebecca Friedman. Our special guests are Nikki Stern and Dan Lombardo. Music, as usual, is by Chris Coleman. Our production assistant was Darren Garvin. Post show is at the Overtime at 5 o'clock. You can go to our website at askanatheist.tv or leave us a voicemail at 206-420-0997. See you next week.
Clay Radio, your conversation station. KLAY Lakewood, Tacoma.